Welcome, everybody, to Lex Line, brought to you in conjunction with our friends at Rug Radio, where we talk about the new and latest legal developments in Web3, blockchain, and cryptocurrency law. As always, nothing we talk about should ever be considered legal or financial advice. If you have a specific legal question, you should consult a lawyer. You should do it privately, not on a live recorded Twitter space. Because yes, we do record these. If you come up and join the conversation, you will be recorded and rebroadcast across our various podcast platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. It is my pleasure to have a special guest in the house today who I'm going to invite up, Jordan Teague. Jordan is a coder and Web3 lawyer in the space. Delighted to bring her in to talk about what she is doing these days, get her take on the current state of Web3 and innovation, and are we seeing a resurgence in interest in building in this space again? So without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome Jordan up. GM Jordan, thank you for joining me today on LexLine.
GM Carlo, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it is my pleasure. I would love it if you could start the conversation by just kind of giving a brief TLDR about who you are, what you do, and how people can find more about you.
Hey, Carlo, I'm so sorry, but I my AirPods just disconnected. Do you mind asking me that question one more time?
No problem. I just wanted to see if you could maybe give the audience a little TLDR on who you are, what you're about, and how people can find out more about Jordan Teague.
Absolutely. So I guess it probably helps by just starting to, starting with how did I even get into Web3 in the first place? So I feel like my first chance really was back in 2017 when my law partner, George Campbell, said, "Hey, I heard this thing called Ethereum. We should buy these really expensive mining computers and mine this stuff." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" But he convinced me. So we bought some miners. We mined some Ethereum for a little while, kept our office warm in the winter, but they kept getting kicked offline. And so we kind of gave up. And I feel like that was really my first opportunity to dive deep. And unfortunately, I kind of missed the boat. Life gets busy. We were trying to build our law firm. But I do remember then, you know, definitely being curious about what is this whole smart contracts thing. And back then, it was still pretty nascent and I think difficult to understand conceptually. There, certainly wasn't any precedent of real products out there in use by any of my clients. And so it was hard to understand how do lawyers even fit into this. But so then COVID came and everyone had lots of time on their hands, or at least I did. This was before I had a kid. and I started reading more, started getting curious about smart contracts again. And so I had a 9-hour block on a flight back from Europe once travel had opened back up. And instead of watching movies like a normal person, I bought the internet connection and I started doing some tutorials on smart contract development and Solidity. And I guess it's also worth noting, it's not the first time that I had forayed into coding. Ever since I was a little girl, I have been interested in software development and web development. So I'm dating myself by saying this, but this was back when the internet was super weird, the wild, wild west. This was the 90s. And I kind of cut my teeth on HTML, JavaScript, things like that. And throughout the years, have always maintained that interest doing things like iPhone app development, database-driven development. And so I definitely had some experience in coding. And that was definitely helpful in propelling me forward. And I know I'm kind of rambling here. I promise this is going to get me to how did I get into Web3 law.
But you're doing great. No worries.
but so grasping the like what does it mean to deploy a smart contract to a decentralized network was a very different very different concept than I'd dealt with before. When you're doing software development in Web 2, you know, you buy your server space, you go get a cheap web hosting account, you do your coding, and then you just sync with the server. Of course, that's not how it works in Web 3. And so it did take me a while. It was a bit of a learning curve to even just conceptualize, like, what am I even doing here when I develop a smart contract and I want to deploy it to a network? But once it started clicking, I was absolutely hooked. And this is what led me to look for other like-minded lawyers who were geeking out on the coding side and curious about, you know, how can I merge this idea of engineering with lawyering? And I was really fortunate to find LexDAO, which is a self-professed group of legal engineers. And, you know, I kind of started learning more about, like, what does it even mean to be a legal engineer? And turns out it was exactly what I was learning how to do, which is merge my love and understanding of technology with my love and understanding of the law and build really useful solutions that could be used in the real world. So I was fortunate enough to get to do some pair group coding with some of the pros like Ross Campbell, one of the OGs in the crypto space. And it was through engaging with LexDAO that I started engaging with Web3 legal issues. So, yeah.
But for purposes of context, when was this? Were you, was this like bull market season, or when did you hook up with LexDAO?
Yeah, great question. So this would have been early 2021. And it's crazy because it feels like it was yesterday. But here we are, 2024, you know, it feels like we're going into a new cycle. But so this was a little while ago. And so, you know, this was my first adventure in Discord, too. Discord is very overwhelming, and I avoid it whenever possible. But so there was lots of chatter about smart contracts and things like that, but then also channels about regulation and legal issues. And, you know, so I started engaging in some discussion there. But one thing led to another, and, you know, I started picking up a couple of clients, you know, a client here, a client there, Web3 companies who needed everything from just getting started like a normal startup to finding a lawyer that could help quarterback all of the weird legal issues that Web3 organizations face. And the snowball just kind of started rolling downhill. Carlo, I know you know this, but the crypto bar is probably one of the smallest, most tight-knit bars, if you can call it that, in the whole world. And so kind of once I started going down that that tunnel, you know, it's like I was in. And actually now Web3 is, I would say, 95% of what I do as a lawyer, which is very exciting.
That is so rare. And I want to circle back and touch on a few things, but I have to agree with you. It's been such a wild ride being a part of this amazing community. And it is one of the, I think, lesser known and sort of more disjointed legal communities out there, but nevertheless full of very passionate lawyers, some of which are in the house today. So thank you for joining us today in the conversation. The question I have is, going back to your discovery of the internet, it sounds like you and I came up around the same time. I was in law school in mid-90s when the internet was just starting to get traction, and we were just starting to experiment with things like email and laptops at school. Smartphones weren't even a thing. What analogies can you see between the Wild West of the internet when you discovered it and the Wild West of Web3 when you discovered it?
Yeah, so the first one that comes to mind is just how weird it is and how many gradients and rainbows and all of that I see. And I know that's kind of silly and not exactly what you're asking, but that was one of the first things I noticed that made me realize this is the internet getting started all over again. Because I remember when I was a little girl, you know, 8 or 9 years old, building websites, the internet looked a lot like a less polished version of what the Web3 internet looks like today. So I think that's the first thing I would say. And what that shows me is that we're maybe at a similar phase in the life cycle of, you know, where everything's still a little weird and appealing to a niche group of us. You know, this may not be the Web3, or it may not look like Web3 will look in 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And who knows, maybe it won't even be called Web3 anymore. That's the first thing that comes immediately to mind.
You know, it's a funny arc because you have this back of the house experience, so to speak, in that you started out with an interest in coding, which then led you into the rabbit hole of cryptography and Web3, and you started doing Solidity coding. And that gives you a unique position because there aren't many lawyers in the space that have that sort of, you know, I think 1-2 punch. What has that done as far as your strategic advantage in being able to advise clients in the space?
So I think that's positioned me as a pretty effective legal quarterback for, particularly clients that are building complicated, complex technology. It definitely gives me an edge to understand a bit about how the EVM works. I'm certainly no expert, and I wish I had time to learn even more than I know now. But being able to go on EtherScan, read a verified contract, kind of understand the gist of what's going on, positions me to be able to figure out, well, okay, what are the legal realities happening here, right? And how might a court or a regulator look at this? Certainly not to say that you have to know how to code to do that. And I wouldn't ever want anyone to think that in order to be an effective advocate and legal quarterback in Web3 that they would have to. But I do think if you have a technical affinity, it's definitely worth learning some basics about Solidity and, you know, the other technological components that are at play, because it will help you to kind of go just that extra 10 or 15% beyond where everyone else might be able to get with your analysis.
The space is moving so fast, and the nature of cryptocurrencies is still something that's largely foreign. And I notice it in my law practice when I sit and I meet with prosecutors and agents on cryptocurrency criminal cases. I can only imagine how difficult it would be for a lawyer who has really cursory understanding of how this technology works. So I think a large part of what we need to do in this space is educate. And I follow you on Twitter and I love your content. Is education and onboarding of new lawyers something that's important to you?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things I love about owning a law firm is that I'm able to bring some of my young lawyers into the fold, teach them about crypto. And you know, it's funny how this industry seems unique, because I totally agree with you that you need to be passionate about this technology and understand it to be an effective lawyer. I don't know if that's the case with every industry that lawyers serve, and I've often wondered why. And I'm wondering if it's just because this is so paradigm shifting that in order to be able to wrap your head around it, you have to be engaged. You know, it's just completely outside, every paradigm we've ever lived with before to think that we can transact digitally without intermediaries. And when I try to explain this to my friends, I've definitely rehearsed these lines many times before, so I feel like I do a pretty good job trying to explain it. Still, half the time, I just kind of get blank stares back. So, absolutely, I think education's important, but not even just education. Trying to ignite that spark, because if you're interested and passionate about what this movement means, I think that's going to make you all the more effective.
And I think that's what makes it so much fun to be a part of this space, is the fact that you're right, different than other areas of legal practice, we seem to have a true enthusiasm for what we're doing, which I can't say would generally translate to other areas of practice, like maybe family law or transactional work, estate planning. People in this space, and I think, hear me out on this, I think it may have to do with the fact that to an extent, we are all fascinated by the possibilities and that we're just scratching the surface, as opposed to other areas of law, which are kind of already, you know, the grooves have been laid. This is still, we're still making this up as we go.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's totally fair. And I wonder if maybe, you know, to your question a moment ago about analogies between what's happening now and what happened back in the 90s, if perhaps that was true then too. I was a little too young to really care about what was happening, you know, kind of in the legal landscape with the internet, but I suspect that there probably were some parallels there too.
Did you have an AOL CD come into the mail for you? Oh. Does that put it in context?
You know it. And I actually, so my father recently brought a bunch of boxes to my house. Apparently this is what parents do when their children are grown and they want to get rid of all of their stuff. You know, he said, go through it, keep what you want to keep, throw away what you don't want. And in that box was actually an unopened AOL CD. And I was thinking, I might actually be able Love to it. Like sell this for something.
Yeah, that is probably a grail now, just like the original iPhone and all the other things from that era. So I want to transition now to where you see the current state of Web3 and legal services. We obviously went through a horrific bear market with a lot of consolidation and a lot of projects that did not survive. Are you seeing now an uptick in phone calls and interest in getting back into this tech?
I would say so. And I would say, you know, we were fortunate to, you know, continue to have a pretty vibrant Web3 legal practice throughout the bear market. I think that part of what helped for us is, A, we're a small firm, so we can be nimble. We can be flexible with engagement terms, you know, that sort of thing. We're approachable. B, we you know, try to put ourselves out there with kind of a crypto ethos brand. But my firm's name is Campbell Teague, but we have this kind of alter ego called the Anti-Firm. And that's really all it is. It's just kind of a brand that we use sometimes. But we've tried to put ourselves out there as, you know, hey, we're lawyers, but we're crypto native too. And so I think those two things, you know, being small and nimble and truly being crypto native have helped us to, you know, be able to serve clients even through a bear market. But yes, it does seem to me like there's kind of some momentum gaining. You see that through, you know, announcements of projects raising new rounds. And obviously no one's complaining about the recent market activity.
Absolutely. Charts are looking beautiful. I tend to share that view because I'm a solo as well. And I don't have a huge emphasis on Web3 as a criminal defense lawyer because there just aren't that many cases out there yet. But it's an area that I have a lot of passion for and been very, very fortunate to have gotten exposure to in handling those cases. And I think one of the things that's fun about it is we're kind of like the pirates of law in the sense that we get to really have fun in a different sort of a way. I never had this kind of engagement with lawyers in any other area of practice that I've had in Web3. And it's so special and unique. I kind of feel like we've found this secret club and people haven't really figured it out yet. Does that sound about right?
Oh, totally. I love the pirate analogy. That makes me feel cooler than I really am. But yeah, I mean, in many ways, I feel like we're kind of inventing the law of the sea as we go. And I know that that's to much of our, you know, many of our chagrin because we wish there were clearer rules for our clients to abide by. But the fact is, especially here in the U.S., regulators have, you know, love to hide the ball and keep things murky to try and stifle innovation. And so I feel like our role is to almost predict what the law should be slash will be in a few years and to help guide our clients in good faith as best we can.
And that's not an easy thing to ask from a profession that is so risk averse and reluctant to take on, you know, unpredictable cases. We tend to be as a profession very risk averse. How do you balance that with the fact that you're going into these uncharted waters?
Yeah. So, well, I guess for starters, I think it definitely takes a special kind of crazy to want to be a crypto lawyer, right? Because like you say, we're in a conservative profession. People are self-selecting into this because they like black and white, because they like rules. And so I think for the few of us that have decided to go this path, we have to just kind of be okay with a certain level of risk tolerance. Of course, always operating in, you know, utmost good faith and searching for the truth and abiding by the law where it's defined. But you do have to have a certain level of risk tolerance, whether that's just, you know, in how you're giving advice or, you know, even for your own clients. But yeah, so you've got to have that risk tolerance. I guess that's what I'd say for starters. Does that make sense?
It absolutely makes sense. And I know that being that we're still sort of in the Wild West, we've saw a lot of projects launch fast and furious and didn't really take the time to consider legal structure, entity formation, taxation issues, and so forth, not to mention the securities aspect of all this that's still a lingering black cloud over the space. When you're navigating and advising clients in this space, Are you finding that they are now coming around to the fact that lawyers are essential to really being able to do things right in this space?
I think they are, but I think what they're finding more specifically is the importance of having that legal quarterback who can help them spot all of the issues from the outset. You mentioned some interesting topics that I think, you know, unfortunately, a lot of projects have kind of realized after the fact, maybe they should have addressed more robustly than they did on the front end, whether it's issues of jurisdiction. Tax is a huge one. I've learned so much from my tax lawyer friends in this space. I think this is an area where, there's been an assumption, oh, well, if we just go offshore, then everything's fine, right? Well, that's not really how that works. That's not how tax law works. It's not how other areas of regulation work. But so I think that what a lot of projects are finding, you know, particularly the ones who have engaged with counsel in the past, is we don't just need lawyers. We need a lawyer that can tell us what lawyers we need. And that's obviously painful from a budget standpoint. You don't want to just pay more and more lawyers, but, as the saying goes, you'd rather cry once. And so, spend the money on legal from the outset, get someone on board who can help you determine what are the issues that I need to be addressing. It might be more painful at first, but it'll be a lot less painful in the long run.
I think it always circles back to the issue of staying within your lane, and the law has become so diversified and it's really difficult to be a general practitioner these days. So if I had to break it down into two baskets, what are the baskets for your core services and your basket for the services that you like to bring in outside counsel?
Sure. Great question. So I suppose core services would be anything that we've been doing for TradFi clients all along. So that would be things that are related to getting started. So incorporation, setting up good corporate governance, contracts, thinking through matters of employment, all of that good stuff, as well as everything companies need to consider while they're operating, that kind of falls in the general corporate category. As a side note, we're also litigators. I'm a litigator by training originally. We love it. We're really good at it. We fortunately haven't had to do much of that for crypto clients yet, although, I think that might be coming down the pipe in the next 2 to 3 years potentially. So that would be core, right? Anything that we would have done for trad law clients. And, the little secret is crypto law is really just law, right? Sure, there are some bespoke laws that are being passed in various jurisdictions, but the bulk of what we do as crypto lawyers is just kind of trad law lawyering under the guise of Web3. And then the things that I would like to bring experts in on are complex tax issues, complex regulatory questions. But even those, I've learned so much in my interactions with colleagues in the space that I've got pretty good instincts now. To where I know, I can tell you, you've definitely got a problem here. You're going to have to bring another counsel probably, but I can go ahead and tell you there's an issue.
That's actually one of the nicest parts about this area and this niche that we're in is the collegiality. I have my DMs open with a lot of the crypto lawyers in the space, and I've always found them to be generally so accommodating and willing to help. And it's just a lot of fun engaging on a whole different level. Do you share that feeling and that enthusiasm for hanging with lawyers in this space?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that reminds me of the early internet too, is online community. I've never had online community as rich and as fun as I have, now with my crypto lawyer friends. It's so fun, but also very enlightening, and I've definitely become a better lawyer for it.
Yeah, I can say without any shadow of a doubt that this is probably the funnest area of law I've ever been involved in, and have made so many interesting and great connections with just brilliant minds in the space, both on the law side and on the creator and developer and artist side. We just are so fortunate that we get to interact with people from such diverse backgrounds and talents and skill sets in the space. It really is a unique thing.
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing like it.
So now you're starting to see interest, and thankfully your firm was able to ride through the bear market pretty well, and that's great. Where do you see us going as far as going forward. I know that there are unique smart contract applications that are being discussed, like the ERC 404 and a new take on fractionalization of NFTs. There are new chains that are coming on board. There is so much going on. Where do you see Web3 going in the next year or so?
Yeah, so I guess there's a few different ways to look at it. So one, you know, kind of what I hear from projects that are getting started is a focus on consumer crypto. And I think what's meant by that term is, you know, a form of Web3 that doesn't necessarily look like Web3 to the average user. And I think even applications like Warpcast and Friend.tech may fit in this category because they don't require you to be, you know, an absolute power user of MetaMask or wallets in general in order to use it, right? So I personally am very excited about that trend. I've always thought ever since I've been in Web3, like I'm a super nerd. I love that it's weird, but that's just not how we're going to onboard the masses, right? So I think we're going to see that trend continue. Another trend that I've seen lately is just this idea of how do we optimize on-chain activity as much as possible? Of course, there are things like layer twos, but then beyond that, optimizations that, you know, are gasless transactions. I'm blanking on the names of some of these projects that have come out, but basically that would provide verifiable proofs that you could verify on-chain cryptographically if you wanted to. And so I'm really curious to see that movement evolve because I wonder if that means that part of the future of blockchain is more things happening off-chain, but just in a verifiable manner. Because, you know, cryptography exists outside of blockchain. You know, it's above that. And then another thing I'm interested in following is the development in XMTP messaging. And the reason I'm interested in this is, you know, I mentioned that I cut my teeth as a litigator. That was in consumer finance and consumer protection laws like the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And so crypto lawyers are very good at keeping an eye on what Gary Gensler is doing and Janet Yellen, but sometimes they forget about the plaintiff's bar. And so I'm curious to see if any creative plaintiff's lawyers gin up any kind of causes of action based on things like XMTP.
Explain a little bit what that is for folks who listen later and may not know.
Yeah, absolutely. So XMTP is a protocol that would allow wallet-to-wallet messaging. And it is a true protocol. You know, it's a network of computer nodes that would, you know, store and deliver and serve up these messages. So unlike, I believe it's SMTP for email, you know, that's more of just a set of rules. But XMTP is a true crypto protocol where it's a network of computer nodes. And so, again, what it will allow is end-to-end encrypted messaging between wallets. And I mentioned that I'm curious about, you know, could some creative plaintiffs' lawyers decide that maybe existing consumer protection laws apply to this. The one I mentioned is the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. And you might ask yourself, well, why the heck would that apply? You know, it applies to phone calls. Well, you might ask the same question then of text messages because the statute doesn't mention text messages. It only mentions calls. But courts have decided since the statute was enacted that they're going to apply it to text messages too. So I think it begs the question, could it apply to other messaging protocols that go to cell phones? I hope I'm wrong, but you know, that's one of the things kind of outside of the normal crypto law discourse that I'm following.
Well, that raises obviously privacy concerns, especially because of the end-to-end encryption. I know that Coinbase has launched its own version of direct messaging, and it's still in its infancy. What use cases do you see for this new protocol? How do you see this protocol being used practically by people in their day-to-day life?
Well, I think it could replace other end-to-end encrypted messaging solutions potentially, or, you know, just be an alternative. So that would be things like Signal. So if you are, if you have a need to keep your data encrypted, I think this would certainly be an option to consider.
Very, very cool. You know, you mentioned what's happening on some of the social apps and how it's really starting to change the use cases for crypto, especially given the L2s like Base, which offer nearly gasless ability to do transactions. I have been experimenting with Farcaster, and I am fascinated by it, and I'm also a little flummoxed that it took this long for something like this to gain traction. It seems like such a no-brainer, and the way you're able to interact with wallets and you're able to just seamlessly launch things on that platform is fascinating to me. What are your thoughts about this, and is it going to get traction?
Yeah, so I saw a really good tweet thread recently discussing, I think the TLDR was, if you're a first-time founder, you think about product. And if you're a second-time founder, you think about distribution. The idea that, you know, many startup founders, their sole obsession is, how am I going to create this really awesome solution to this problem that I've identified, or a solution that society doesn't know that it needs, but they forget to think about distribution. So I wonder if it could be as simple as Farcaster just tackled the distribution problem better than, you know, any of the predecessors did that tried to do something like this, because it certainly isn't the first or the only. Lens Protocol comes to mind. I think there are many others that have attempted to be this decentralized social platform, but none have gained the traction that Farcaster has. So I wonder if it could be as simple as that.
I think one of the things that's really innovated with is this use of frames, which I haven't really been able to scratch the surface of, but from what I can see, it is a really simple way to launch code via this app. And that code can be for any number of things, including polls, including NFTs. And, you know, as a coder, are you fascinated by what's happening over there?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. And I could be wrong about this. I only briefly looked at frames and kind of technologically what it is, but it kind of looks a lot to me just like an iframe. And I tweeted something that completely fell flat, because I think, you know, most other people aren't 90s kids like us, and they just didn't even know what I was talking about. But I was like, hey, everyone, you know frames were invented in the 90s, right? So obviously this is more innovative than just a standard iframe. It has a little more purpose to it, but I think that's essentially what it is it's kind of an iframe that lets you build an app within an app. And I think that goes to distribution. I think if you're able to do something like that, that does give you an organic distribution mechanism and a way to pull people on.
That's actually fascinating. I would like to kind of explore that. For those who are going to listen back later, talk about what that original iteration of iframes was and how this is sort of building on top of that, because I think that's a fascinating point you've made, which probably did go under the radar.
Yeah, so I don't know why iframes were created, but essentially it's just an HTML object that allows you to embed another HTML page within kind of a different parent page. And I think that there have since been a lot of restrictions placed on them with cross-domain content. So it's a lot harder to do iframes now than it used to be, because browsers just won't let you do it. But it was just a way to, you know, you could embed something from one site onto another. And so that's kind of what frames is doing, right? You know, it's allowing content that's hosted by someone else somewhere else to be embedded within the social platform.
And the possibilities around that are pretty amazing, because what I think it solves, especially when I look at how easy it is now to connect your wallet via this app and mint NFTs and share things and claim things, and there's this rewards aspect to it, it seems like it's kind of doing what we've wanted for a long time, which is making this technology accessible to people in a way where they don't necessarily have to understand how the sausage is made.
That's right, they don't. And if I'm remembering correctly, you don't even have to connect a crypto wallet to Farcaster. I think most of us do, because that enhances our social experience to do that. And there are things you can do within the frames if you do. But right, I don't think you have to know the first thing about Web3 to join Warpcast.
Which is pretty cool, and we'll keep an eye on that and see where it goes. So 2024, what is Jordan Teague's goals for 2024 in her law practice?
Ooh, man, that's a big one. I probably should have thought about this one before the new year, huh? Right? we're trying to grow. I will say that. We are, you know, we're a small firm, but we started as a two-man band, and we're up to six or seven other lawyers now, three project managers. We are hoping to onboard at least two more seasoned laterals this year. We would like to ultimately have a presence all the way down the East Coast. We are primarily a Southeastern firm, although obviously our client base is all over the place because crypto and private equity and things like that. So I guess that would be our main goal is, you know, we want to increase our reach. And I think that would position us really well in the next bull run to be a really great partner for a lot of awesome crypto projects.
And from that recruiting perspective, where are you finding that most of your qualified recruits are coming from? Are they coming from Crypto X or are they coming from LinkedIn?
Yeah, so we have had some good luck just connecting in kind of the crypto law community, crypto Twitter, that kind of a thing. But I think that's a problem that we're still trying to solve as relatively young business owners who don't necessarily have a very strong background in just growing a business is how do you recruit? So I'm always open to ideas.
You know, it's one of the things they don't teach you in law school is how to run a law practice. And it is hard. You have to wear many hats. And especially when you're growing at the pace that your small shop is growing, it presents its own unique set of challenges because you've got to delegate more, which is probably something that's a little counterintuitive from when you were a two-person shop.
Absolutely. And I've thought about this a lot lately. I wish that earlier in my career, someone had told me to start developing those skills then. We spend so much time as young lawyers honing our craft, grinding, billing hours. And that's so important, right? Because that's how we build deep subject matter expertise. But then it really is a completely different skill set to delegate because, you know, delegating isn't just saying, do this thing, right? Like anyone can do that. And you can say you delegated. Good for you. Pat yourself on the back. But effective delegating is much more difficult because it requires a real wisdom of how you break down an assignment, communicate it to someone else in a way that you know, ultimately does save you time, but empowers that other person to do what you need them to do. And it's very difficult, especially if you're, you know, an introvert like me who can lock themselves in a basement for 12 hours and code. You know, it doesn't come first nature, but it's so important to learn.
And then combine that with all the other responsibilities, including payroll, taxes, and all the other things we have to manage when it comes to law practices. It can be a lot. It can be daunting.
Exactly.
So are you speaking anywhere in 2024 that we should put on the radar for people? Will you be at NFT NYC or ETH Denver, anything like that coming up for you, Jordan?
Yeah, so I'm definitely heading to Denver. And I found that ETH Denver can tend to be a little last minute when it comes to talks and panels and that kind of thing. But I do know, for starters, that I will be speaking at a side event that's organized by some crypto lawyers called Law at the... Is it Law at the Edge? Law at the Limits. Law at the Limits. And that is going to be on Friday, March 1st from 1 to 7. I think I posted about this a few days ago, so you could definitely find this on my feed on Twitter. You do have to register, but it's free. It's going to be a very cool event. There's going to be some crypto law rock stars there like Gabe Shapiro, Stephen Pally, and then, you know, people like myself. So, but come for the stars like Gabe. and I'm not yet sure about New York or the other events coming up, but we'll see.
I love it. This has been a delightful conversation, Jordan. I'm glad to get the chance to get to know you and for you to get the opportunity to talk to the community at large. Before we close out, is there anything you'd like to say? And of course, I would definitely love for you to provide your handles so people who want to follow you or listen to the podcast later can find you.
I guess the final thing I'd leave everyone with is for crypto clients trying to find lawyers. I really feel for you. It's such a difficult thing because, finding a lawyer is difficult for any client, right? You can't really ask a lawyer who they represent. a lawyer can't really share a lot of details about their representations because they're, attorney-client privilege. And then layer on the fact that crypto is an incredibly complicated field where you really need to vet the subject matter expertise of your lawyer. So I'm always happy to talk to anyone about, just how to find a lawyer. Dane Lund wrote a really great article that I think I reposted recently about how to find a good crypto lawyer. I try to just push this message as much as I can because I really do feel for projects that are really doing the best they can to get legal counsel, but it's so hard to find a lawyer.
Equally hard to find a good CPA or accountant who understands crypto. That's another area that needs to see massive growth.
Preach.
For sure. So how can people find you, Jordan, if they want to know more about you?
Yeah, so twitter.com/JordanTeague. That's Jordan like Michael Jordan and Teague like the word league, but with a T. You can see I've had to do that before. That's probably the best place to find me. Our website is CampbellTeague.com, and I would love to hear from anyone. Always happy to geek out about Web3.
Yeah, for those who are not following Jordan, I encourage it. You post some great zingers. You make me laugh out loud sometimes with some of the things you post. So I really enjoy your content. And again, I want to thank you for joining and everyone who joined the conversation today on LexLine. Remember, if you missed it today, it will be up. I will try to get this uploaded on both Spotify and Apple iTunes this weekend on podcast format. Absolutely enjoyed the conversation, Jordan. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day to join me.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Carlo. My pleasure.
And I hope you and everyone who joined us today has a wonderful weekend, and we will get back at it again soon. Thank you again, everyone, for spending your day with LexLine. I appreciate it.